Hi, and welcome to Power of 10, a podcast about design operating at many levels, zooming out from thoughtful detail through to organizational transformation and onto change in society and the world. My name is Andy Pullane. I'm a service design and innovation consultant, trainer, coach, educator, and writer. My guest today is Jim Kalbach, an author, speaker, and instructor in design, customer experience, and strategy. Jim has worked with many large companies and is currently head of customer experience at Mural, the leading online whiteboard. He is the author of Designing Web Navigation, of Mapping Experiences, and most recently, The Jobs to be Done Playbook. Jim, welcome to Power of 10.
Thanks for having me, Andy. Great to be here.
So just in your job at Mural, you must be having an interesting time right now. We're talking just in the sort of still in the midst of coronavirus crisis.
Yeah, it is absolutely interesting here. You know, when you have a crisis like this, which is almost unparalleled in the world, some people will do really poorly, you know, business-wise, and others might actually benefit from it. We're lucky to be on that other side, where we're actually seeing a lot of interest in our business. Of course, first and foremost, we also believe we can help. We can help people collaborate better remotely, but you know, in terms of our business, I think we've never been more relevant with a sense of urgency on that, and we're really stepping up to try to meet the demand.
Yeah, I can imagine. I can imagine it's also been, you know, whatever plans you had for scaling have kind of just gone crazily compressed into, can we do this in a week and not the next year or two?
On all fronts, technologically, hiring, revenue, I mean, everything has just been hyper compressed, and we're trying to keep up. You know, we are a startup, but we're handling it pretty well, I think, as a company. And you know, it's got everybody scrambling and working on the weekends, but we want to be there for people. We want to be there for our existing customers and for others who are reaching out newly to us.
That's interesting. You're going through the sort of startup to established within a kind of very short amount of time.
It's interesting. You know, I joined the company 5 years ago, and we were kind of just entering our teenage years, so to speak, you know. Yeah. And, you know, I've been saying, you know, just to kind of summarize the effect that the COVID virus situation has had on our company is like, we're adults overnight now. Like you know, and I don't think we'll ever like go back. Like even after the situation loosens up with the lockdowns and things like that, we will forever. Our trajectory has been, you know, catapulted into a different orbit.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, for a lot of people, you know, there's a lot of talk about, you know, what's going to happen when we go back and stuff. I read a thing yesterday, which was 9%, only 9% of people in the UK want things to go back to the way they were. So it's hard to imagine that you're going to ever get back to a situation where someone says, you know what, I've got some life stuff I need to sort out. I'd really like to work a couple of days a week at home.
Right.
And for their employer to say, no, that's not really possible. You know, it's never
Exactly. Yeah. No, I think it is a little bit the art of possibility in terms of team collaboration and productivity. Mm. It's been a big test. Can we do this? And I think that's proven out.
You know, you guys must have gone through, but so has everyone else, this idea of, well, you know, as a remote worker, you might have been an edge, you know, so-called edge case, right? Which I know a lot of people have been stopping using that language and talking about stress cases instead.
Yeah.
And now, of course, everyone's an edge case, which actually you realize why the edge case versus stress case kind of terminology makes such a difference, because we're in a stress case. And I'm guessing you guys must have found out quite a lot of stuff on sort of stress cases, but also all the businesses kind of using this stuff.
Right. Absolutely. You know, for me overall, I've been in remote work for a while now. My previous company was Citrix, the makers of GoToMeeting teleconferencing solution. And then, you know, now here at Mural, I've been looking at the remote condition, you know, in general for nearly a decade now. And, you know, my position was always, it's not an either or. It's really about momentum and flexibility and agility as an organization, that, you know, you don't have to be in person and you can do the remote, but that doesn't necessarily replace the in-person collaboration. Yeah. Right. And now with this, like we were saying, you know, this stress test kind of showed that it is possible. And I hope, my hope is that continuum then kind of sticks around, that people realize that it is a viable option. But the relevancy of what I was working on 8 years ago in terms of how do we approach remote work is it's now overwhelming. It's a tidal wave.
Yeah, I can imagine.
And I can't, the number of posts, I think you have one, Andy, the number of posts, tips on remote sessions, and it's all this, it's coming out of the woodwork, and it's thrilling to me to see everybody talking about about it suddenly.
You know? Well, you were the first person, however many years ago it was, who said to me, one was, you know, if one person is, you know, on video, everyone's on video, even if the rest of them are already in the same room. I'm very, very clear about this idea of, you know, being careful and inclusive about the people who are effectively trapped in the mushroom on the table, right? And it's so easy for the room to end up having a conversation with each other and go, oh yeah, and by the way, Jim, is that, what do you think? And is that, and then, but also this idea that, you know, organizations take care, sometimes great care, about the physical workspaces. And yet the virtual workspaces, it's as if it's a kind of cupboard under the stairs and, you know, really kind of neglected. Now, of course, all those companies are finding out the value of having invested in that. And it's not just the technology, it's also the sort of the muscle memory and the kind of etiquette and the way of working that everyone's used to or not. You know, everything from everyone turns their mics off when they get into the call through to kind of other stuff, I guess. So for you, you must see all of that. And I remember you talking about that.
I call it the digitally defined workspace. And, you know, there's been a lot of attention on the physical office environment with beanbag chairs and free catering and all that kind of stuff. And that's fantastic. And the kind of the notion there is you want to have a positive employee experience, because that's going to lead to a positive customer experience. But then you look at the digital workspace, where we actually spend more of our time, most of our time collaborating, and it's not only neglected, it's just sometimes it's just a pile of tools that IT people provide access to without any instruction on how they fit together. All the etiquette. I mean, it's all about etiquette. I've also always said, Andy, that our tools are actually far better than our muscle memory and our skills at using them for remote collaboration in particular. That we can do a lot more than our tools allow for, a lot more than we're actually doing. And I think that's exactly what we're learning right now. Everybody's kind of pushing the boundaries of that. So my hope is that this digitally defined workspace will actually kind of come together, and where businesses will realize, oh yeah, that's not just a soft skill. That needs to be hard-coded in our attention as well too.
And how we work together is a nice kind of segue into jobs to be done, I guess, because it's sort of largely the difference between, you know, it's one of the differences between the two, which is it's not a pile of tools, but there's a need here that we're addressing. So you start the book talking about kind of, well, in an introduction and also sort of understanding jobs to be done, with a kind of bit of a history of jobs to be done too. So I'm going to ask you the question I'm guessing you've been asked over and over again, which is, what's the job to be done that the book is there to satisfy?
It's a great question, and I thought about this a lot. I think there are a couple of jobs, but for me, overall, the main job of the Jobs to Be Done book was to present the field, which does have a decades-long history, in a way that is not too theoretical or obtuse, that a practitioner couldn't grab onto, and then a related job to be able to apply it as well too. Clayton Christensen, who is generally credited from any modern perspective of jobs to be done as kind of the founder of jobs to be done theory, did just that. He created a theory. It was a theory without practice. And other people took that up and actually created a practice around it. But it was either very large and monolithic or obtuse in some way. And you're going to understand the theory if there's a practice with it. So yes, you can read about it, but I think you're going to go do it and then go back and say, that's what they were talking about with the theory. So what I wanted people to have, that aha effect with a practical application of it, so that they could understand the theory. So the real job was to kind of break it down into a place where people could actually go out and do something so that they could grasp it.
Yeah, there's a bit in it which I highlighted, which you say in the introduction, is most distinctions between strategy and execution are meaningless. Which I really like. And I think it's partly to do particularly with my kind of experience, but unpack that a little bit more.
Sure. It's highly indirectly influenced by Roger Martin, who I think we know from, you know, his design thinking in the business world, kind of anchoring design thinking in the business world. And he's written about this topic as well too, the misinterpretations of those words. And it might be semantic. the difference between strategy and execution. But, you know, if you think about a hierarchy of strategy, right? Mm. So you have corporate strategy, but if I'm an individual contributor, you got to break that down to business unit strategy, to product line strategy, to product strategy, to maybe within that, there's another strategy, right? So that one layer's strategy is the other layer's execution, yeah. right? So in the first place, there's a hierarchy. And then when you start looking at it, it's like, well, everything is execution and everything is strategy in an organization. And that's how Roger Martin poses it. But he basically says that it's about decision making, that anybody who's making a decision as they're doing their job is actually making a strategic decision. So therefore, execution has a strategic decision making component to it, as well as an execution decision making component. And there's therefore it's two sides of the same coin, and they're one in the same.
Yeah, I mean, I was talking before about the kind of different Zoom levels and that kind of
right,
very
exactly.
much
yeah,
kind of,
right,
yeah. you know, is music to my ears. But I think also this idea, I mean, one of the things that's always bugged me about design thinking in the way it's sort of come to be understood, I should say, is that this, you know, at least 2/3, if not more, of the thinking being done during design happens mm-hmm. during the designing, right? And that bit sort of gets overlooked, and I think it's often then bolted on as we did our sort of design thinking workshop for a couple of days, and now we're just going to execute the way we always execute. And you set this up quite differently in the book. And in fact, that's a thing that you say around the book, that jobs to be done can kind of work at multiple levels in multiple disciplines.
Yeah, yeah, no, I mean, again, you know, it's kind of the job of the book was to make jobs thinking. And I apologize for using that word. I couldn't think of a better word, Andy, than jobs thinking. And I don't want that to be a buzzword, by the way. That's just how I see it. It's a mindset, right? It's not it's not a theory, and it's not a patented method or, you know, trademark method. That it's a way of thinking. Hmm. And for me, that's the real power of it. Is there's a shift. Sometimes there's like a 180 shift where you explicitly and intentionally remove yourself, your brand, your product, your solution from the equation, so that you get this kind of pure bare bones understanding of the problem in and of itself, which leads to what I've been calling recently as an out of body experience. out of body experience, meaning that, you know, companies and organizations are really good at looking at their markets and talking to their markets through the lens of their own brand and solution. Right? Oh, consumer, buy my product.
Yeah, yeah.
Consume this, right? Customer journey map. It's a story. It's their own story, actually.
Yeah.
Customer journey map, very selfish document, by the way, Andy. It's basically our own story of our own go-to-market strategy, right? But what Jobs helps us do, and it's not the only thing that does this, by the way, but what Jobs to be Done does is helps us see it completely the other way around, right? Again, explicitly. And that's the out-of-body experience that I think a team or an organization can get from Jobs thinking.
It's just struck me that we're talking about this because we both know what it is, but maybe you could take a step back and actually explain what is Jobs to be Done for anyone who's listening to this and doesn't really kind of know it, because there is a dance between the kind of methodology, if you like, and the mindset, which I think you just kind of talked about.
Absolutely. So Jobs to be Done, I think, is a perspective that looks at individuals, not customers or consumers, but looks at individuals as goal-seeking actors in the world. That's kind of the core of the perspective. And I do see it as a perspective. And the goals that they have, I refer to them as objectives, have a process around them. So it's not just a task. It's not, you know, picking up a pencil on your desk. It's something that has a process around it. And I refer to that as an objective that has a process that we can understand from the individual's perspective in order for an organization to have better insight into innovation opportunities, into better insight into opportunities for improvement as well, too.
So it's most clear, I think, when you give an example. Can you give an example to sort of explain the shift from one to the other?
Sure. So you know, I give this little example in the book that I'm actually trying to work with right now, because I want to have a very clear explanation of what jobs are in general. Oh, and by the way, I want to say, it's not a job like a career. The word job, and I know in different languages that's problematic. For instance, in German.
Yeah,
which does have the word job, which means a career. That's not what it refers to. So a synonym of a job to be done would be an objective. that someone has, right? And it's also not the job. It's also not your job. I have this little exercise at the beginning of my workshops where I have people write job statements, and they start saying what they would do to provide a solution for the problem that I present to them. It's also not your job as a solution provider. It's purely from the individual's perspective, what they want to get done. And it gets a little bit complicated because there's, I think you might appreciate this, there's levels of hierarchy or abstraction at which you can look at jobs, right? There are smaller jobs and bigger jobs. And in the field, they talk about small jobs and big jobs. And then there are aspirations above that as well, too. So you have to fight with granularity, but you can basically define a job at any level that you want to innovate. The first question is, at what level do you want to innovate, right? Yeah. And then you can compartmentalize a statement around a job. For instance, get energy in the morning.
Yeah.
Right. If I want to get energy in the morning, we can think about solutions that fulfill that job. And you know, coffee comes to mind, right? So if we're a coffee manufacturer, we might want to think about how we can tweak sales of coffee with branding and get a different bean and stuff like that. But we could also say, hey, people want to get energy in the morning. And by doing that, we have this out-of-body experience that allows us to then ask, well, what else gives people energy in the morning?
So one of the things that's interesting when they're formulated, right? And so you have this sort of structure where you said it's a verb plus object plus clarifier is just how simple they are, right? So if I can read an example out, so you have a kind of, you know, wrong and kind of don't do this, but do it like this. One of them was... the job wrongly described was search by a keyword for documents in the database. And you say, well, you know, that includes a specific method like keyword search and the technologies that documents in database. And actually the job to be done is retrieve content.
Correct.
Yeah. Or, you know, people prefer to attend meetups and conferences that are nearby, and you just attend an event is the job to be done.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, it is deceivingly simple and also deceivingly hard to get that to frame it the absolute right way. An example that I've been using recently in my talks and workshops, Andy, is the answer to the question, why did the chicken cross the road? do you do this in the UK? Is that a joke in the UK?
That is a joke.
Yeah. Okay. It's to get to the other side. By the way, the first time I used that example, I was in Germany in Frankfurt, Andy, and nobody knew the answer to that question. And I realized I outed myself as an American with that example. but it is that simple. So what Jobs does, like I was saying, it there's a forcing function where you force yourself and your team and your organization to focus on the core objective with a process around it that you're trying to solve for first. So you want to find that first. Why did the chicken cross the road to get to the other side? Do we really understand how chickens get across the road to the other side? And we can map that out. And there's a language around how I would describe a chicken crossing the road. And guess what? It has nothing to do with my brand or my customer journey map or my existing product. It's just that. Then in another step, we can layer onto that things like emotion and aspirations, and the solution and the brand come after that. But what Jobs says is that opportunities for innovation and improvement come from fundamentally fulfilling that job first, and then you can add the other aspects, assumptions, and biases of our brand on top of it after that.
Right. Yeah. And you actually, I was talking with Lou Down about their book, Good Services, and talking about this idea that, you know, well, one thing was that they write in the book, you know, services are what users or customers say they are. Your brand or your service is whatever the user says it is, and nothing the other way around. But the other idea, we talked a bit about sort of wow moments and my kind of dislike in general for this idea of wow moments. And you say in the book as well, you know, if you don't get the functional bit of the job right, you basically don't earn the right to do the kind of emotional bit. Or if you just go for the emotional job and fail to actually deliver the functional job, you kind of just failed entirely, right?
Yeah, that's the rule of thumb. I do present that as more or less a hard rule in the book. However, I've personally been in situations where you wonder if that's actually the case, and I've talked to other people where they don't wholly buy into that. I think, though, from the job's perspective, though, that would be your starting point. You would believe that to be true, that I need to know how do chickens cross the road first before I try to make an emotional appeal to the chickens to get them to cross the road back.
I think there's a trade-off. And I think the most glaring example of that is kind of operating systems, right? Of kind of Windows versus Mac, or, you know, Android versus iOS. In that there's a balance between, or there's a trade-off between the two that you make. We know, you know, I'm going to sacrifice some kind of functional thing for some other kind of emotional thing. And I think that probably happens in all sorts of things. You know, it happens in when people... with cars, or it happens in quite a lot of physical products as well.
Agree. And here's the point. I'll kind of reiterate now that you set that context up. That trade-off will happen, but it happens in a specific order. That you first look at the functional job, then you smack that up against all of those emotional, aspirational, and brand aspects, and then you make the trade-offs, not the other way around. So that sense, jobs to be done. It's almost a process. That you need to start there and then do those other compromises or diagnoses afterwards.
Right, but you might let in that kind of trade, you might let the emotional side kind of win, if you like.
Agree. You absolutely can. And I have a great example of this where I was working for a provider of online women's fashion. Yeah. And I don't know if you've ever worked in online women's fashion. I learned a lot of things. It was eye-opening. And we were looking at things like jeans. Which I didn't realize were so problematic in terms of fit. But the space is wholly emotional and about personal brand and how you look. Like, there's this social and emotional jobs that go along with online women's fashion. But the key problem that we identified, in part using a little bit of jobs thinking that I injected there, was, do the jeans fit? Right. So it was a functional job that was going to be the wow effect, or the thing that we knew we had to solve first. Right. So even in spaces where I thought, no, this is all about, you know, aspirations and appeal and things like that, it actually did come back to a functional job that we needed to solve first.
So let's talk about the hierarchical nature of this, because you've got this kind of micro job, little job, big job, and then aspiration. And obviously, it kind of triggered the whole, you know, Zoom levels thing in my head. I have to admit, and if Nate is listening to this, he'll well know, I was sort of quite a jobs to be done skeptic in the early days. In fact, it was him who kind of converted me. And partly because we were working on a project where there was research scope creep. So that was one thing, where we went from what should have probably been about sort of 20 or 30 interviews to about 100. And so we had a kind of a real synthesis problem with it. And obviously, one of the things that jobs to be done is good for is synthesizing. Mm-hmm. And it was very, very hard to work out what level of abstraction, or what level of kind of job, I guess, are we going to sort of synthesize this in? Because it felt like the further up you went, the less, it's not that you couldn't group the stuff into jobs, but those jobs became less useful for a design team. Mm-hmm. Because they were things like be seen as an expert in the community or something like, which is why, how much can we kind of influence that? And so certainly I found for kind of design teams, a couple of levels down were sort of more useful, because it was something much more sort of concrete that they could actually design artifacts for. What are your kind of views on this?
I think that's it. I think that's exactly the issue that jobs to be done address is what's your unit of analysis, and at what level can you realistically have agency? And I think sometimes, and I've done this, I'm guilty of this, Andy, I don't know if you've ever done it, where you go into a session, a workshop of some kind, and you're swinging for the fences, as we like to say in the US, you know, just blue sky innovation. And you are trying to, you know, make people feel like an expert. You know, that's a great aspiration that you have, but you make widgets.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So where's the agency? And then you walk out of that room with a wall full of post-it notes, and everybody goes back to their day job. The example that I like to give is actually a quote from Theodore Levitt that actually inspired people like Clayton Christensen to come up with jobs to be done. And you've heard this before too, is people don't want a quarter inch drill, they want a quarter inch hole. Right.
Yeah.
And I just had this on LinkedIn where people then started ripping it apart, say, no, they want to hang a picture. No, they want a better home life. And if you can, so jobs to be done is not a game of five whys, because if you play that game, then a job to be done is happiness, love, and self-actualization. All the time. Love, self-actualization, and happiness are not great places to innovate.
Yeah.
Right. And particularly not if you're a drill manufacturer or a drill bit manufacturer, right? If I'm a drill bit manufacturer, maybe I want to make better holes in the wall. But, you know, how far, what's my reach of agency that I can actually innovate around? And what I like to do is find the thing that's comfortable, so you can take your team of designers and find the thing that's like super obvious for them to solve, and then stretch it and go up one level and say, yeah, we're going to solve that level up. That's where I try to come in on, okay, this is using jobs to be done as a framing mechanism. This is where we're going to innovate, right? But if you go too high, then you're just, you lose gravity. You're just floating in outer space, you know?
Yeah, it's weird. I mean, I had this feeling that we were, it was like a skimming stone, you know? We ended up, either we would have had to have like tripled the amount of synthesis time to really drill deep into each one and have a kind of massive set of jobs to be done that we could then work from. Mm. Or you end up kind of with this, I mean, that's the paradox of research, right? The more research you have with qualitative research, the more you have. If you don't stretch the synthesis time at the other end, yeah, if you've got a fixed amount of time to do that in, you end up going shallow. And so ironically, you think you're getting more, but in fact, you kind of get less insight because you can't go as deep. And I think that that was the kind of the struggle we had. There's the opposite thing, though. I mean, you were talking about kind of lifting a team up is actually to kind of bring people down a level too. Yeah. And I think a lot of clients I've kind of worked with and teams I've worked with, they do start a little bit too high sometimes, right, which is, you know, we want to be the number one. And right, anyway, it comes from that company-centric point of view, right? Which is, oh, we want to be the number one customer experience in whatever it is, you know, telcos or mobile phone purchasing or whatever it is. And that's part of the problem. That's such a kind of broad thing, and it sort of misses the point.
Agree. And if you look at the solutions of those companies and how well they satisfy their core job, the thing, the functional thing that people are actually trying to get done with their solution, in most cases, there are gaps there. Yeah. And opportunity for growth actually come from filling those gaps or extending that core job rather than putting layers and layers of assumptions, bias, brand, and yeah, ego on top of it, right?
And those things are often quite kind of banal and boring. That's
They're
the thing.
I think
that's
a bit disappointing.
People always think innovation is this kind of really exciting thing. And actually, this daily thing that I work with is really frustrating and tedious. I wish someone would make it a bit better.
Yeah.
There was a bit you talking about sort of people, telcos are the classic kind of churn case. There's a famous thing in Jobs to Be Done about jobs interviews and switch interviews. Can you talk about that? Because you talk about it in the discovery bit.
Yeah, sure. There are a couple different schools of thought around Jobs to Be Done, and practitioners have developed, you know, one approach versus another approach. And I think jobs interviews, as I describe them, and switch interviews kind of fit firmly in two leading camps or schools of thought around Jobs to Be Done. The first jobs interview is, you're obviously working for an organization, so you need to scope the field, the frame of research, right? Yeah. So if you work for an insurance company, you're not going to talk to people about how they listen to classical music, right? Yeah. You need to have some frame of reference before going into those interviews, and that's your business motion. Like what field are you in, right? So you need to do that kind of framing, and then also from within that, trying to frame a priori, trying to frame the level of altitude that you're going to be targeting as well too, before you go into those interviews. But after that, you're not talking about a product or solution or anything like that. You're really just framing the interview starting from which direction am I pointed out as an organization? Doesn't even have to be a business. And then in a much more bottom-up way, trying to interview people about what they're doing independent of a solution or product, right? So it's kind of moving forward or bottom-up. The switch interview is basically saying most of us have products and services on the market already. Hmm. So I can use that to reverse engineer back to the product, right? So what I'm going to do is say, when did you adopt or acquire that product? And through questioning, this isn't rocket science. If you've ever done contextual inquiry or any kind of qualitative interviews, you might read this and say, I've been doing this. And the answer is, yeah, you have. Just use your interviewing sensibilities. But what you're looking for in a switch interview is you're starting from that point where they adopted or acquired something, and trying to go back to moments before that. What's the thought before the thought before the thought, until you get to what's called the first thought. And from there, you can deduce what the actual job was. So for me, it's like one building up and the other kind of reverse engineering back. But the idea in both of those is that you're going to get to this unfettered job description of what they were actually trying to do, that underlying objective that people had.
So we've been sort of talking about using the sort of research end of things and using jobs to be done as a way, as different lenses, or a way to, as a lens or a way of looking at that. And the nice thing is it does work at those different levels, whether it's kind of strategy, or it could be a kind of technical thing, or it could also be obviously a kind of UX or service design thing. Let's go down the other end, which is about testing hypotheses with it. So because obviously, and depending on how much there's a kind of iterative process going on, and a kind of loop back going on for design teams, at some point someone will have done the synthesis, and a team will have decided these are what we think the jobs to be done are. Obviously, those are also best guesses unless you start to validate them. So tell me how it can be useful in that validation end of things.
Sure. Well, first of all, I think some of the techniques in from jobs to be done can be very helpful in coming up with a hypothesis or theory, I should say, where to start testing, right? Where are the weak points? If we just take the functional job, for instance, let's say we take the job of a chicken crossing the road or getting energy in the morning, right? I could map that out in steps, and then use it as a diagnostic tool to come up with a collective theory that the team buys into that says, oh, here's a weak point and here's a weak point, and we're going to try to come up with solutions for those weak points. Those then become the inputs for something like a lean experiment. We believe that if we notify the chicken about oncoming traffic more, that they'll be less likely to get run over by, right? Whatever that hypothesis statement
they will achieve their job quicker,
right? So, we would pick a moment there that would then be the input into experimentation. I think the other thing too is through jobs interviews, for instance, what you can look for are success criteria. And that's the interesting thing about jobs to be done for me, is that it actually separates the process from the desired outcomes or the steps from the needs. So what we can actually do is then look at those needs or the desired outcomes that we've extracted from our research as measures of success for the experiment as well too.
Can you give an example?
So if a chicken were trying to cross the road, the desired outcome might be increase the speed at which the chicken can cross the road. So then speed becomes a success metric for the chicken in determining whether a solution from an experiment or otherwise would be the best fit for them that addresses an unmet need. Now that might be super obvious, but the jobs process actually is very thorough at uncovering a complete set of desired outcomes that you can then try to prioritize and then hold those up against your solution and say, does this help with the speed of crossing the road?
Yeah, no, that bit was really nice, because I think one of the things that I remembered when was my ex-colleagues in Australia, and they had kind of had this nice kind of way of measuring impact for the work that Fjord does. And it had that kind of mix that you talk about actually very early on. So when you're talking about those different types of jobs, when you're saying, well, hang on, you've got the the sort of functional part of the job, but you've got also these emotional jobs, and then you've got these kind of related jobs. Those extra bits all become criteria by which you can measure, right? So you can say, well, I've achieved this job, and I feel, you know, more confident or more trusting in that or not. So there are some nice qualitative things that you can measure, but there's other stuff around, I guess, the adjectives and adverbs around when I'm doing this in this context. I want to be able to do this. And so, you know, it could be, I can now do this quicker, or I get my job done quicker or better or whatever. And those are all measurable things. And all the way through the book, you talk about, you take that sort of discover, define, and design and so forth, but each time you put value behind it. So I'm going to ask the sort of naive question, if you like, what was the idea behind putting the word value, discovering value, define value, designing value, delivering value, rather than just, you know, discover, define, design?
It's a good question, and it's tricky as well too, because value, you know, you were talking about this before, is what the individual perceives. Right. Yeah. We don't create value. People perceive value. Right.
Yeah.
So I crossed a fine line there. But I was asking myself, and I think I talk about this in the introduction to the book. I was saying, what's the job of an organization? And, you know, I'm pretty much focused on commercial organizations in the book, but it could be an educational institution or even a government. You know, what's the job of a business, let's say? And I found this this blog post. The author escapes my memory right now. He's fairly active on like the Financial Times and Forbes, but he was saying there's basically four jobs that a business, any organization has in order to grow. And that's to discover where the value is that they're going to go after, to define that, then to create it, and then to deliver it to the market. So he didn't use those terms, but when I read his four statements, I said, well, there's four D's there as well too. But going back to my answer on what's the job of the book, I also wanted to show that jobs to be done is pervasive throughout an organization at any point. Yeah. And I don't want to present that as a process. In fact, I use a figure eight to kind of show that's different modes that an organization is in at simultaneously. You're in discover mode, you're in design mode, you're in deliver mode, that kind of thing. I wanted to show that you could apply techniques from jobs to be done at any one of those points and at different levels of altitude as well, too. So for me, it was actually, you know, to be honest with you, though, Andy, that's the long-winded answer. The short-winded answer is I needed a way to organize all of the plays that I had. And it turned out to be a nice way to just have one chapter flow to the next chapter, flow to the next chapter.
And so I've got a question about you, which is a writing question, which is at what point did you make that decision? How much of the manuscript had you got done or had done a first draft?
I had that structural decision right way up from early on, luckily. And I think it works. It's actually kind of irrelevant, you know. I show, and the word value. So the back to your question, the word value is that's ultimately what an organization does, right? But sometimes I'll show that figure eight in workshops, and then I structure my workshop after that. And it's just a rubric. It's just an umbrella. You know, it doesn't really do anything in and of itself.
Right? So for people, because this is a podcast, but the figure of eight has those different stages, but it's an infinite loop, right? It looks like the infinity sign, in fact. Yeah. And you're right. You know, everyone's doing, any organization is doing all of those things all at once, which is often forgotten, because I think organizations often mentally think of themselves as a assembly line, and there's just stuff rolls off on the end into people's homes, and, you know, they get money.
One of the other things that I really liked about Jobs to be Done when I first came across it in 2003 was that it wasn't coming from the design field. It didn't have that weighted, loaded term of design attached to it. And it was coming from the business field, and anybody can own it, right? Yeah. You know, currently in my current role, I manage a team of customer success managers. So I'm, you know, involved in tangentially in customer success communities, and they're talking about Jobs to be Done. And I gave a talk in September last year, and it was something like Jobs to be Done for Customer Success, which starts on the other side of my loop, and it's for a specific audience. Yeah. You know what I mean? And then, you know, you hear marketing people, sales people, all kinds of disciplines around an organization are latching on to Jobs to be Done. So I wanted to come up with a structure where, like you said, you can access it at any point, but you could also have any flavor of Jobs to be Done as well, too.
So you may know that I rant generally about how products are actually services, and especially digital products aren't really products, you know. And so for the thing I wrote the other day, I think I might have even been a comment on your blog post, was that I consider Jobs to be Done the ultimate proof that products are in fact services.
I'm on board with that. I'll take that as well too. I'm also not dogmatic about my position around Jobs to be Done. I'm not an active consultant of, you know, Jobs to be Done. I do have a lot of practical experience, but I've been following the field long enough, and of course I've been following UX and service design as well too. So I get your drift right away, and I would absolutely agree with that.
Yeah, I mean, it's because there's the most extreme version of It's called service dominant logic, is, you know, a bottle of water is actually a thirst quenching service, right?
Right,
not,
exactly.
Not a bottle of water.
So. Right. Yeah, no, exactly. Yeah. So you bring up a really good point, because a lot of existing disciplines, particularly from design and service design fields, they say, haven't we been doing this? Haven't we been doing this since, you know, Alan Cooper came up with goal-directed design and goal-based personas? And, you know, isn't contextual design, don't they talk about the same thing in the book Contextual Design, when, you know, contextual inquiry? And it's like, yeah, it's the same mindset. It's wrapped up differently, though. And I think that's important.
Yeah.
Because a customer success person isn't going to pick up a 500-page book that has the word design on it, find those pages that are relevant, extrapolate that to their field, and then make it actionable.
Yeah, no, that's very true. No, and that's the thing, I think, out of all the things that I kind of was a bit of a penny drop when I was reading the book, that bit where you kind of talk about that at the beginning, was like, oh, yeah, he's right. I'd not noticed it.
Yeah.
And then I realized that. And for anyone who's, so I've just started offering design leadership coaching. And one of the things that comes up all the time, which you're not taught in design school much of, is basically having conversations with stakeholders. And then the further up you go in design, the less actual design work you do. And the difficulty comes from, you know, it's rare that you're sitting there going, this is a tough design problem to crack. It's all the kind of people stuff. Mm-hmm. And it struck me how useful this is for people in that to think about how you can kind of reframe conversations. And I think you're right. You know, language matters, and words trigger all sorts of things and reactions, and they open people up or shut people down. And that was actually an insight in there that I thought was very, very good. And I really can recommend people having a read of it. So listen, we're coming up to time. I talked about, you know, this designer working at many different levels of Zoom from the Eames film. So I ask every guest, what one small thing is either desperately needs to be redesigned and is overlooked, or is well designed and unknown, that has an outsized effect on the world?
Right. Yeah. I haven't been thinking in that while I was talking, because it was such an engaging conversation. Thanks again for having me here, Andy. But I do know that, you know, those small moments matter, right? That they can make a big difference, whether somebody's in or out, and even be life changing as well, too. I was invited by an NGO in Abu Dhabi to lead a workshop working with ex-violent extremists. I actually did a mapping exercise to map their experience. So there were violent extremists who got out of the movement, and we wouldn't understand their process of getting out, in particular, what they did afterwards, how their life went on afterwards. So, and we threw stuff from my last book, Mapping Experiences, into the workshop. And it was great, because here I am with ex-violent extremists in the room, and NGO people and people from the State Department in the US using mapping experiences and sticky notes and design thinking and all that good stuff. But there were some very interesting conversations there about how do people get on the wrong trajectory as well, too. And things as simple as, you know, having after-school programs for kids to give them some meaning, like a karate class or something like that. And one of the former violent extremists who I'm now in contact with was saying that if he had, I think it was karate lessons, if his parents could have continued paying for his karate lessons, he might not have become a violent extremist.
That's amazing, isn't it? It's like girls being able to have a safe, you know, pathway to school or something like that.
Exactly. But the point at which that happened is minuscule. It's totally small when you think of, like, so to fight Al-Qaeda or to fight ISIS, we need to do more after school programs. It almost doesn't make sense. The logic doesn't make sense. But it might be like, yeah, actually.
Oh, well, it's a good thing. It's a good example of what happens when you kind of ladder up and think about the job, which is, you know, help you find meaning.
Exactly. And violent extremist organizations are really, really good at recognizing that people have a gap in meaning in their lives and filling that in. That's what it's all about. Yeah. That's how that happens. If you pre-fill that gap with something meaningful, karate lessons, music lessons, whatever it might be, right? Would we have less hate in the world? I think so.
I think so too. That sounds like a good place to end. Where can people find you on the interwebs?
On the interwebs, you can go to my LinkedIn page and connect with me on LinkedIn. I'm happy to chat with people there. I love meeting people if you find me on LinkedIn. And then on Twitter at Jim Callback, no dot, no space, just at Jim Callback.
Jim, it's been great. Thank you so much for being my guest on Power of 10.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, Andy.
As I'm sure you're aware, you've been listening to Power of 10. My name is Andy Pullane. You can find me at apullane on Twitter or pullane.com, where you can find more episodes and sign up for my newsletter, Doctor's Note. If you like the show, please take a moment to give it a rating on iTunes. It really helps others find us. And as always, get in touch if you have any comments, feedback, or suggestions for guests. All the links are in the show notes. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.